Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's been just under a year since Russia invaded Ukraine, a year that has transformed the lives of every Ukrainian. So this hour, we're going to hear from Ukrainians about what they've been through these past 12 months and how, if they do, they find hope. Ukrainians like Julia Tymoshenko and her father, Serhiy Tymoshenko. When the Russian invasion began on February 24th last year, Julia and her mother fled to Lviv, close to the Polish border. Her father, Serhiy, chose to stay in Zaporizhzhia, the small village where Julia grew up and from where her father commuted to his job in the capital, Kyiv. Serhiy told us about that moment when he realized that his village was an early target of Russian forces. Julia relays his story.
On the 6th of March, he was returning back, and he usually takes a train. And the train stopped, like one stopped before our village, so in the village nearby, because going to our village, the bridge, which also would connect the train, was destroyed.
Serhiy got off the train and walked across a footbridge to cross the river into his village.
And as he says, direct quote, when I was walking into the village, the people were running towards me and like yelling, "Where are you going? Like, turn around, because there are already tanks approaching."
Meanwhile, Julia was hundreds of miles away and terrified when she learned that the village where her father and grandparents still remained was under attack.
Oh, it was like probably one of the hardest times in my life. I was extremely anxious, and I remember just crying because I saw the images of the church burning were on CNN that day. And the church, I'm not religious, but the church is a big symbol of my home.
Look at this. This is a church hit by Russian forces in a small village about 30 miles from Kyiv.
The small wooden church in Julia's village dated from the 19th century. That CNN video shows the church with its bright blue walls and green roof ablaze. Julia feared what the Russian forces might do next.
Obviously, I was really horrified that they might start going into houses and they might start, you know, taking away food from people interacting, or even worse, like killing them.
It didn't take long for Julia's fears to be realized.
A day when they entered the village, they decided to go to the center, and basically they started breaking into shops and stores and just like stealing and looting. And also they started to situate themselves into the people's houses in the village to spend the night. So my dad is saying that also the civilians and the people started to kind of situate themselves in the cellars and make themselves kind of comfortable and make, as he says, direct quote, appropriate conditions in the cellar as much as you can to spend the night while the hostilities were happening.
Luckily, they never broke into Serhiy's home, but they came very close. He watched from his windows as they broke into his neighbor's house and looted it. It was a terrifying time.
They also were torturing multiple people and they tortured to death, like in Mokrets. There was a couple of people that as well, like either didn't have electricity or heat in their house, and they went to their neighbor, and those were old people, 60, 65 years old. And they were found in a cellar later, and they were found with torture wounds, like their body was like blue, like their limbs were like broken. And their faces were completely beaten up, and they were thrown in a cellar. And one more guy, he says, was also tortured and killed. And then when they interacted with the villagers, they would always like point guns at you, and they would like take away phones as well.
And this lasted for weeks. Serhiy and his neighbors lived in fear, not knowing what would happen next, until the Ukrainian forces showed up.
And I read it on Twitter, like I read the name of my village and the other village that I went to school, that it was liberated. That made me feel so hopeful and just happy. I think like that's the first moment I felt happy and hopeful in the whole a month and a half of the war. And then the same like few hours later, my dad actually sent me a text message that reads, "Ours are here, like our guys," which means like our army is here. And that was like one of the most incredible messages I've ever received in my life.
That was on March 28th. After more than 3 weeks of Russian occupation, the family's village was now free. But much rebuilding was needed. Roughly 15 homes in the village were damaged or completely destroyed. The church in ruins and the bridge connecting the train to Kyiv was in need of repair. Today, the train is back up and running, and Serhiy Tymoshenko has resumed his commute. And in June of last year, Julia Tymoshenko and her mom returned to Kyiv. I now want to turn to Ivan Gomza. We spoke with Ivan last May after he had just returned to Kyiv after being internally displaced in Lviv with his wife and young daughter. He's a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. Welcome back to On Point, Ivan.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you've been back in Kyiv since May. How's your life been different than it was, say, a few years ago?
Well, you know, it's a funny question to ask because actually it both has changed. And on the other hand, it hasn't changed much because I have my job, the very same where I used to work prior to the war. My wife, she has her job as well. And even our child, she goes to the daycare center, which luckily is functional. So, I mean, on those basic realities, some like main points, they have been preserved. But on the other hand, as a professor at the university, I have several drastic pieces of news that my students, they actually perished in the front. Some of my colleagues, they were mobilized. And many of friends of mine, they actually quit Ukraine, left Ukraine, especially females, and they relocated to abroad.
And talk a little bit about things like power outages, I understand, are happening, and even air sirens. Like we saw when President Biden visited Kyiv yesterday, that there were air raid sirens going off even as he walked with the president.
Well, definitely, Russians decided to make a presentation for President Biden. I mean, that air alert, it was pre-scheduled to scare him. Regarding the air sirens, actually, yes, it happens constantly in Ukraine, in Kyiv especially. Don't forget, I can relate only about Kyiv's experience. I think people in Kharkiv, they have other stories to tell. But in Kyiv, it happens, the sirens, quite often. And actually, we, the citizens, we grew to ignore them. I mean, when it interrupts your working day or the night when you try to sleep, every 3, 4, or 4 hours, you either ignore it or you simply can go mad. And power outages, well, yes, it was and it still remains a problem. But actually, I would say that it was much more drastic in December and January when we had no power for several hours, sometimes for several days. Actually, that was very difficult. Both physically and psychologically, because don't forget, December, January are very short. Like there is not much daylight. So when it is dark at 4 p.m. and it is dark at 7 or even 6 a.m., it's quite taxing on your optimistic worldview. But once again, the situation has ameliorated a little bit. Today, for instance, the power has been constant at my apartment. And actually, the last week, I would say that in Kyiv, once again, there are no power outages anymore, yeah, for the moment of being.
So talk about your daughter. She's only 3. What does she think about living with things like these sirens going off or having been moved back and forth? How is she doing?
Well, actually, she is a very young baby, so she practically is not aware about anything. I mean, being a 3-year-old, she does not understand what the war is, what the threats and dangers it brings. So for her, the most annoying thing is or was the air sirens, and I used the past because actually here in Kyiv, unlike Lviv, we don't hear them really because we live far from the locality where the siren the mechanism is situated. So she doesn't hear it, and that is why she actually forgot, I think, how hellishly they can scream. And in contrast, when we resided in Lviv, it was just somewhere around the corner, maybe even near the our window. So she was terrified. She had a special phrase that I quote, "Siren is a very, very bad song, which makes me scary." And actually, during those days in spring, when we heard sirens, we actually tried to run and find some cover. Nowadays in Kyiv, we actually don't do it. We, as I told you, we ignore them.
Yeah. So you started by saying that life in a way was like normal, but in a way not at all like normal, especially since people that you know have been lost in the war. How are you doing personally?
Well, I would say that my personal situation is not as drastic as of many Ukrainians. Even the previous guest whom you were quoting just before, obviously she and her father, they had much more direct experience of disasters and suffering. For me, actually, it's quite okay. I mean, I have not seen dead bodies. My neighborhood has not been shelled. Only several rockets were flying over my head. Yes, I saw several Iran-made drones, which actually often have a trajectory flying through my vicinity. Sometimes I see people with machine guns trying to down them. But all in all, I would say that for me, I haven't seen much of the war tragedy. It is just around the corner because friends and people whom I know.
Yvonne, I'm going to pause you right there and we'll talk more on the other side. We're talking about life of Ukrainians after a year of war. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. This hour, we're discussing the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion in Ukraine and how this past year has been for Ukrainians who have remained. We're joined today by Yvonne Gomza. He's a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. And now joining the conversation is Olga Buzanova. She's the co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project. We spoke with her back in May from Kyiv. Olga, welcome back to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for having me here.
No, thank you for joining us. And before we get to you, Olga, I want to give Yvonne a moment to finish making the point he was in the last segment about how he's doing now.
Well, no, you don't have to do it. I mean, I finished my idea. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Olga, you've been in Kyiv the whole time of this invasion. How has the year been for you?
It was tough. I mean, in the beginning, it was very frightening. And then the situation in Kyiv was better off when the Russians left, when our army made them leave. But then in the end of the previous year, the shelling started, so as well as the blackouts, and it is quite it has become quite a weird situation to live in a civilized city with obvious lackage of power and electricity and the water supplies, even sometimes. So quite weird.
So why did you stay? Why didn't you leave like other Ukrainians did?
Well, I have my white family living in Kyiv, and my parents are quite old, so I had to stay with them. And I have my work And the project of Ukrainian Witness, which was started immediately after the invasion began. So I had to do anything to help the country and to help my close people, although my own children left the city.
Yeah, talk about that. You sent your two young girls away to Poland. How did you come to that decision, and what was it like living away from them?
It is very, very difficult for everybody in the family, for both them and myself. But we started from like leaving Kyiv. I mean, they left Kyiv immediately before the invasion started. And then it was understood that that won't be like peaceful back in Kyiv. It won't be like before, I mean, in terms of their education. And so we decided that it would be better for them to live in Poland. I'm visiting them from time to time.
Yeah. So talk a little bit more about what daily life is like in Kyiv in comparison to how it was a couple of years ago.
We have regular alarms because of the shellings and because of the drones which are sent into Ukraine. They are very different. I mean, we have learned how to distinguish between them in terms of their danger, because there are like Telegram channels where you can read if the missiles were started or if the drones were coming and the cities they are heading. So you have the possibility to distinguish where when you have to leave and into safer place. And they are quite regular. So we're having like each 2 days we have an alarm, or even it might be several days without any alarm, and then several of them in 1 day. So we have, it is better off now. I mean, the last week was quite good in terms of power, electricity, but we had times where I myself had no electricity for a whole day. So it has become also a routine that you have to have your additional batteries full power. You have to have your cell phone charged. So, and you have to have the place where to go in terms when you need connectivity, when you need cell phone working if there's no power. So we have like these points, hot points where you can come and just work if you need to. So we're getting used. I mean, we're getting prepared to having less of the civilized, utilities.
Mm-hmm. And Yvonne, what about in your neighborhood? I know you said you were faring better than some other Ukrainians, but there's still been some destruction there too, right?
Well, destructions, they are relatively minor, but on the other hand, unlike the other guest, for us, the power outages for 2 and 3 days, they were like quite regular. And for this reason, there was no water because water pumps, they didn't function, and no central heating. Well, we have autonomous heating, but without electricity, this thing doesn't work as well. So it was cold and dark, and in this respect, it was difficult. I mean, civilian life during the wartime is predominantly dark and hard.
Yeah.
Even without destruction.
And Yvonne, you said that you saw some, you know, rockets flying overhead, but when it comes to the invasion itself, were there any close calls for you or members of your family over the past year?
Well, actually, yes. And when I say the closest call, it was just the very first day of the invasion, because my parents, they have an apartment at Warzel. Warzel, it's a small city near Irpin and Bucha. And actually, I spent many, many beautiful days in both Warzel and Bucha. So during the first day of invasion, they told me they had a plan to wait it out there but I convinced them to go with us. That was the closest call, I would say, of mm-hmm. a personal experience of a disaster, because should they go there, they would have spent several weeks, I think, under the occupation. Fortunately, it was a close call, but we evaded it.
Yeah. Olga, how about you? Were there close calls for you and your family?
Sorry?
To extended family, I would say, because, well, most of my close family members live in Kyiv, and Kyiv was bombed, but it didn't experience that hard as, for example, Kharkiv did, or as Kherson did. So we in Kyiv, we are almost more or less okay, if it's possible to say so. But my like cousin and her grandma, they lived in Bakhmut, which is one of the most active atrocities point at the moment. And they had their my grandma, she's not my direct grandma, but the sister of the sister-in-law of my grandmother, and she had a house there, a private building, and her granddaughter had a flat in the center of the city, and they fled to Kyiv in summer last year, and that was a very good decision, although they didn't want to do it, because obviously the city is devastated at the moment, and they are still with us. They live in Kyiv, but obviously everything is lost. I mean, all their we even don't know if they are ruined, the houses, or not. But given the pictures I, for example, myself see, as we work with within Ukrainian Witness, it is obvious that the risk of that both of the livings were ruined is almost 100%.
So back in November, Olga, there were reports that there might be possible nuclear warfare. What did you do when you heard news like that? How did you try to prepare?
You can't be prepared when it comes to a nuclear disaster. I mean, we've lived through Chernobyl disaster, and the only thing you can do is have regular precautions, like where to go, or some premises under concrete things or something. But mm-hmm. it is very short term, and that was another thing why I was confirmed that my children shouldn't come back to Kyiv. But I'm not sure it is possible to 100% prepare to a nuclear catastrophe.
Yeah. Yvonne, how did you prepare, and are you still concerned about that possibility?
Well, October, it was the month of October, and that was the month of the nuclear scare in Ukraine. And to make the point really fair, I did not believe, and still I don't believe, in a nuclear strike against any major population center in Ukraine. But on the other hand, my wife, she was freaked out because, you know, there was constant information, barrage of information, if you will, that Russians, they might use a tactical nuclear device. Maybe they would try, for instance, flood some nuclear water in Dnipro. So actually, my wife being freaked out at one period of the time, she decided that we need a kind of an exit strategy. And yes, during nuclear disaster, you cannot have a sure strategy, a safe strategy. So what we did, we stockpiled plenty of bottled water, because the alpha particles, they cannot penetrate the plastic, and water is very important for your survival. So we had plenty of water. We still have plenty of water bottles in our apartment. We also bought 10 packs of special overcoats, rubber overcoats, just to cover yourself in case of a fallout. And we also had three six pairs of goggles, two for me, two for the wife, and two for our daughter, because eyes need to be must be protected against radiation as well. So as a joke, we don't have the one thing we definitely don't have from Fallout games. It is Geiger counter, and they were in very short supply, so yeah, we couldn't buy it.
Right. Olga, you co-founded the Ukrainian Witness Project. What have you witnessed through your work over the past year?
Well, not very many pleasant things. Many of the, well, it was, if you start like looking through the materials, there are plenty of them, and all of them are, well, they are speaking about pain, about ruined nations, and it is quite painful to see how the country is ruined and how the people's lives are ruined there. And we had many interviews, and one of the thoughts that was like coming up to my mind when I was looking through some of them is how many like bright people we are risking to lose in this war, because the best go there, and well, it's awful. Well, So many of the cities, we are actually making the materials at 0 point of the war. So after the war moved from Kyiv, we started to go to like those places, and we have many of the interviews from Bakhmut, from Kharkiv, from Kherson. We were the first to enter Kherson after it was liberated by the Ukrainian army. So we saw the ruinations, we saw those Russian flags, those things on the buildings they were putting, and it is something which makes our country bad. It poisons the country, so it's painful to see that.
How do the people, I mean, especially given the destruction and loss, what helps people keep their resolve?
The support when we are like very close, I mean, supporting each other. It is helping, because if you care about something or someone, then you feel better because you feel needed. It is also the sense of humor. It is, I think it is a very Ukrainian, like distinguishing characteristic is the ability to find something to still keep up and keep the humor up. Obviously, the help we are getting from other countries, it is also very, very, very much keeping ourselves, because we understand that we are not alone, and it is very, very supporting.
Yvonne, you're back to teaching. How is that, and how are your students handling this, especially since, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, some of them were lost in this battle?
Well, I would say that students are actually managing to cope with the situation brilliantly. Just to give you one clear-cut example, several days ago they had a final exam on one of my courses, and they invest much time and energy in mastering the material, precisely because for them it is a way to, as they put it themselves, we made a special opinion poll among our students. So for them, it is a way to regain normalcy and to refine some ground under their feet. But on the other hand, from time to time, they individually lapse into problems. I have a student who had a clinical depression because her classmate, who was my student, he perished literally while trying to recapture Bakhmut. So there are individual stories with different twists and plots. And on the other hand, as a cohort, they do it very well.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have Ivan Gomza and Olga Buzanova pause right here. We're discussing the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion in Ukraine and how this past year has been for Ukrainians who've remained. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about how American educators teach the history of slavery in this country. K through 12 teachers, we want to hear from you. How do you talk to your students about slavery? What are the challenges? What has your experience been like teaching this subject? Share your story with us by recording a message in the On Point Vox Pop app. If it's not on your phone already, just search for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps, or you can leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. Today, we're discussing the one-year anniversary of the Russian invasion in Ukraine and how this past year has been for Ukrainians who have remained. Olga Buzanova is co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project, and Ivan Gomza is a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. And now we're also joined by James Elder. He's the Ukrainian representative at UNICEF. The United Nations Children Fund is an agency of the UN responsible for providing humanitarian and developmental aid to children worldwide. And James also joins us from Kyiv. Welcome to On Point, James.
Yeah, hi there, Kimberly.
So we've heard a little bit from Olga and Ivan about how some of the children in their lives are coping. How would you describe what this year has been like more broadly for children in Ukraine?
Look, it's utterly devastating. You know, it's just the last thing that the entire world needed, much less boys and girls of Ukraine. It's another nation of children who have suddenly learnt what war looks like. You know, of course, things had been happening in the Donbas for 10 years, but if we talk about the intensity of that attack, as you mentioned, Kimberly, a year ago, an attack that continues to go on in residential areas, continues to be heavy artillery in places where children should be safe, then in the last year, the boys and girls of Ukraine have learned that, you know, an air raid siren means run to a bunker or a basement and hide and wait out, you know, the next attack. And I've met so many parents who, with little children, could sort of talk them around that and pretend it's a game or something. But older children, as Ivan was speaking about, can't do that. And of course, you know, amid all of that, you see children in bunkers time and again looking at their parents now after a year, thinking, really, this again? So it's very dangerous. You know, lots of children killed, lots of children injured. I saw children again this morning from Bakhmut with horrendous injuries from shrapnel. And then trauma on top of trauma, the psychological impact on children who are enduring this is immense. And unfortunately, UNICEF has experience of that around the world. And that can have grave impacts on learning, emotional support, all sorts of things, the longer a war like this goes on for.
Yeah. So you're talking about the impact on learning. This invasion happened during the pandemic, so there was already a dramatic impact on children's education. Talk a little bit about how the war compounded that.
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone around the world got a sense of what that looked like, of the isolation, of, you know, not seeing friends at school, of everyone being cooped up in a house. And then just as the world was taking this collective breath, there's an invasion. So suddenly schools are shut. No chance for children to have that moment to have a break and to see their friends and to pretend that this horror isn't happening all around them. No chance for their parents to have a break, remembering that, you know, whilst an organization like UNICEF can be in Dnipro or Zaporizhia, near those contact and front lines, it's mums and dads who invariably are the first responders. They're the ones dealing with kids. They don't get a break when children aren't in school. So, you know, that sort of thing of COVID for children has just continued and continued. Now, government's made a big push. We've made a big push. First time I think I've ever seen UNICEF. We're reinforcing bunkers under schools or putting in, you know, electricity or lights or, you know, Wi-Fi. But still, you know, a school will only take as many children as not considered desks but can be in a bunker after an air raid siren. So that limits the number of boys and girls there. Many join online as well, but maybe there's an attack, maybe there's a blackout, maybe they're underground, maybe their teacher, you know, is hiding in a bunker. So education, like everything else for boys and girls, has been absolutely thrown on its head, as you say, Kimberly, after they'd already had 2 years of lockdowns and everything else that everyone remembers so bitterly from COVID.
So talk a little bit about how the children are doing mentally, emotionally, psychologically, given whether they've been displaced, whether they've lost loved ones, or they themselves have been injured or lost some of their friends.
Yeah, look, not well. I mean, to get precision, of course, you'd have to talk to a psychologist or a counselor. So from the day one of this war, I was in Ukraine, and you talked to mothers and children and the tens of thousands, millions of people fleeing. And it was just this overriding sense of sorrow and sadness because no one wanted to leave. I don't think I spoke to a single person who wanted to go, and they hoped that this would be a short-term departure. But as it's gone on and on, we've seen the immense impact, devastating impact it has on boys and girls' mental health, on their well-being. I mean, you know, basically, the Ukrainian children have come to learn that the world can be really unstable and unpredictable, and it can be a terrible place. And psychologists will tell you that, you know, such a loss of a basic sense of safety can have a really catastrophic effect for boys and girls. And we know that that goes beyond, you know, that can be reduced learning, that can be reduced earning in years to come. So it's an immense amount. Again, mums and dads are that front line. I mean, UNICEF has reached about 3 million Ukrainians, caregivers and children with psychological support. Remembering, too, though, that those children and so on displaced in the country, or the many as well outside the country, the millions of Ukrainians, they're not with their dads as well, you know, that. So whilst people around the world might change channels on this crisis, Ukrainians are still living through a horror story, and fathers in Ukraine are a world apart from their children. You know, when I was in Kyiv, gosh, the last time in September, it was just that little bit quieter. It felt like a moment of normalcy. And I spoke to so many dads who had this real hope, this twinkle in their eye, almost a tear in their eye, that, you know, their wives and their children may just come back. Then, of course, it wasn't long after that these brutal attacks started again on water, power, heating, all the things that everyday people need, and it, you know, making it so much more difficult. And that crushed the hope of a nation of dads to see their children again. They just don't know where that light is. So the strain that must put on mothers and fathers and, of course, on children is enormous, Kimberly.
James, do you and the folks at UNICEF, do you have what you need? What resources are still needed there for children specifically?
It's never ending. I mean, I have all these numbers in my head, but I mean, we really have reached millions with clean water and millions with medical supplies. I remember in the earliest days, it was medical supplies to the front lines, but it was medical supplies across to hospitals across the country, which was anything from, you know, resuscitation kits to midwifery kits, because, you know, Ukrainian women were suddenly having babies in bunkers, and that was saving supplies, and it was a wonderful sort of, it was a bit of a, you know, a bit of warmth to a day in a sense, because when you meet these Ukrainian doctors, invariably women, I guess, because I've met Ukrainian doctors whose husbands are doctors on the front line, so I always tend to be meeting women. I mean, the tirelessness, the round the clock, month after month, you know, day after day. So that sort of support, you know, it's going to an incredible place, whether it's doctors or volunteers and so on. So, but to answer your question, no, because the need continues. We'll always keep outstripping that need. And UNICEF, of course, is, you know, there is no magic pot of money. It's all, it's donor funded. It's from the generosity of people. And so that's, you know, we keep having to make those pleas. But as you mentioned before, after people have suffered themselves through COVID or after UNICEF, we keep our eye on every other crisis, from the earthquake now to a possible famine in East Africa. Yeah. It's a lot, but, you know, a child is a child wherever they are.
James Elder is the Ukrainian representative at UNICEF. The United Nations Children's Fund is an agency of the UN responsible for providing humanitarian and developmental aid to children worldwide. James, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kimberly.
And we are still with Ivan Gomza and Olga Buzanova from Kyiv. I want to talk a little bit about this anniversary and what support from the world has meant. President Biden made a previously unannounced visit to Kyiv yesterday. In a nearly 10-minute speech, Biden reiterated U.S. support for Ukraine and praised the country for its strength this past year.
Mr. President, I'm delighted to be able to repay your visit to our country. In Washington, not long ago, you told us, you told the Congress, quote, "We have no fear, nor should anyone in the world have it," end of quote. You and all Ukrainians, Mr. President, remind the world every single day what the meaning of the word courage is. From all sectors of your economy, all walks of life. It's astounding. Astounding.
Ivan, what has the support from organizations like UNICEF or the support that's expressed by allies like President Biden meant for the Ukrainian people?
Well, they mean everything. I mean, we are having an asymmetrical conflict right now. Russia has a bigger population. It had stockpiled more weapons. So without that support, we wouldn't survive. And let me remind you, today we didn't mention it, but this is an existential threat for Ukraine. So without the world support, without the Leopard tanks, without HIMARS, without, during the first days of war, Bayraktars, actually, the situation would have been very, very bad. I mean, a year ago, President Biden, he told that very gloomy days, dark days are awaiting Ukraine. And now we know that everybody expected that Russia will actually overrun Ukrainian army and then guerrilla fights. That's everything everybody was envisaging for Ukraine. So that support provided by the global community, it makes the difference between a guerrilla fight in Kyiv and artillery duels around Bakhmut.
And Ivan, I know the last time we spoke, we talked about the morale, the will of the Ukrainian people at that time, 6 months in. Now that we're at the one-year anniversary, have you seen anything changed, or is the resolve, from where you see it, just as strong as it was then?
Well, you know, that year, it was the hardest year both in my life and I would say collectively for Ukrainians. So it had its ups and downs. I mean, if you think about our psyche back in February, it was very bad. If you consider, for instance, the situation in June, when it was much bloodletting, and actually Ukraine has not yet received at the moment of time support from the world community, global community, it was hard. But it also had its ups, and definitely since the Kupiansk operation by the Ukrainian army, since the liberation of Kherson, since that January, I mean January 2023, when we received Patriots, or at least our crews are being trained how to use them, we are actually again very, very sure that we are going to do it. And when I say we are going to do it, I mean we are not going to lose it.
Yeah, we have lost Olga Buzanova. We're trying to get her back. But Ivan, do you think about life after the war? And what does that life look like to you?
Well, me personally, as a private citizen, I actually try not to do it. I mean, because you must not have plans when you have a war on your hands, because everything can happen. Let me give you an example. Several months ago, maybe a month ago, Ukrainian social media, it was devastated by a story of a woman who brought her children to the daycare center, and she didn't come back to collect them because a rocket hit her car. So after that event, many moms, she required, you know, some psychological help because she were crying, she were sobbing with their doctors, asking, what if the same happens to me? So the point I'm making is that you must not have plans because it is unpredictable. But on the other hand, not as a private citizen, but as a political scientist, yes, for sure, I am trying to build scenarios to predict what is going to be after the normalization of the situation occurs.
Yeah. And as a private citizen who is reluctant to try to imagine what comes after the war, Ivan, what keeps you going in real time to get through the conflict?
Well, day-to-day things, day-to-day preoccupations. I mean, just in several minutes after we finish this conversation, I'll run to the daycare center to grab my daughter. Then I'll have to cook her some food. The next day, I have some classes to grade. So that is something which makes you, you know, dive deep into the everyday reality and not to think about what might happen. And on the other hand, you don't build plans in order not to be shattered when they don't realize.
And what about your students that you teach? What keeps them going?
Well, I would say it is just the very same situation. I mean, when they are in classes, naturally enough, we have plenty of discussions when we apply the material we read to the ongoing war. But on the other hand, when they do it not, let's say, as private citizens, but as analysts, as scholars. And I see that detachment, it actually helps them to realize what is going on and to persevere.
Ivan Gomza is a professor of political science at the Kyiv School of Economics. Ivan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we were also joined by Olga Buzanova, who is the co-founder of the Ukraine Witness Project. We thank her for joining us as well. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.